Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:06 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is May 4th, and it being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. There has been a great deal of uncertainty expressed by a lot of people, and not without good reason, but then we have to at least pay some attention to the consistency of trends. And I think that that is the most important fact, because the region of the trend mean has offered an area of support on successive occasions since about 2010. There have been occasions when the index traded below the trend mean, and by the index I mean the S&P 500. And I'm only talking about the S&P because it has been the benchmark for the USA, and the USA has been the leading market. There is certainly still this Wall Street leash effect, and if the US were to move into a bear market environment, then that would have a knock-on effect for just about everywhere else. So what happened in the course of the last year was we saw some evidence of acceleration, and there was a risk of a pullback towards the trend mean, and that's exactly what we got in February. That coincided with the implosion of the short VIX trades, and it I think chastened traders to the extent that they had been betting on the one-way move in the contraction in volatility, and didn't pay much attention to the possibility that volatility can in fact rise. It takes time for volatility to come back down after a spike, and that's exactly what we've seen. But the most important point is that we have a progression of higher reaction lows since that February low. If we zoom in and just simply look at the daily chart, it is quite evident. And as long as we're seeing support coming back in at progressively higher levels, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to higher to lateral ranging. That doesn't mean that we're going to see the index pushing on to new high ground in a very rapid manner, but what we are seeing is that there are an increasing number of large cap shares that are either trending still reasonably consistently or have broken up and away from their respective ranges. And Apple is the largest share in the world, and it broke out to new all-time highs today. This has been a very emphatic move this week. One of the points that I've made over the course of the last few months is that, generally speaking, at m important medium-term peaks in the course of this decade-long trend for Apple, it has lost consistency at the penultimate high before a medium-term correction. And it did potentially look like that in the range that we've had over the last few months, and it has now it is at least beginning to countermand that conclusion with this very clear upward dynamic. If we get upside follow through over the course of the next few weeks, then that will I think conclude this period of ranging, and then we will have the next leg upwards on this uptrend. When we look at the size of the pullbacks, then reactions of approximately $30 are now what have to be considered normal. After a much bigger reaction like we've just had, then the consistency of the trend has been impacted somewhat, so then we have to give it some additional room. And that is, I think, one of the important points. If you have to give positions a little bit of additional room, then if that also implies that there is more risk, and if there's more risk, then position sizes don't have to be quite as large. That's exactly how algorithmic trading systems work. They work off volatility, and I think that that is probably also how people should be considering how to size positions when they're looking at their investments. The fact that Apple is firming here, and Amazon has been the clear momentum trade. Well, it moved to a new all-time high last week, and it pulled back for most of this week, but it has been firming. And this has been a relatively shallow consolidation in the region of that $1,600 area. Google had pulled back to the psychological 1,000 level, and it is showing evidence of firming from the region of the trend mean, and it absolutely needs to do that. This has been the largest pullback that we've seen in quite some time. Every other time it's pulled back, it's done so by approximately $100, and this has been a $200 pullback. So what that suggests is that the imbalance between supply and demand that animated what was one of the most consistent trends in the world has had some damage done to it, and it is going to take time to convalesce. My conclusion has been that this is a medium-term correction and that it could be anything from 6 to 18 months in duration. It is encouraging, however, that we are seeing progressions of higher reaction lows on the S&P 500 and indeed on the NASDAQ 100. This was a clear upward dynamic in here today. And I think we can say now that we have two higher reaction lows, one at the beginning of April and one towards the end of April. And it continues to hold the upward bias, and it is continuing to find support in the region of the trend mean. The fact that we're seeing these indices firming from the region of their respective trend means on successive occasions obviously tells us that other people are watching that that measure as well. A lot of people will have been trading on the basis of the 50-day moving average, as the trend was very consistent. We had a number of emails talking about what was the best moving average to use during 2017 because we were in this high momentum environment. Well, we've had a rotation, and now there are a number of particular indices that are generally doing better. The semiconductor index has bounced from the region of the trend mean in here today. It very quickly moved on to new high ground after the February pullback, but wasn't quite able to hold it. And the fact that it has bounced now from the region of the trend mean is encouraging. It will have to follow through on the upside to break the short-term downward bias, but as long as it's trading above the trend mean, I think people are going to be reasonably sanguine about the medium-term outlook. Then you have the kinds of companies that have adopted subscription business models. Microsoft, for example, has not pulled back by anything like the kind of severity that we've seen in other shares, and part of the reason for that is because of the fact that it has transitioned to these subscription models. Cisco is another example of that. A number of the games producers are also have adopted these subscription business models, and even Activision, which had very clearly accelerated, has now bounced from the region of the trend mean. It was Adobe was the very first of those companies but Adobe was the first of those companies to adopt a subscription model, and it remains in a tight, consistent advance that has certainly picked up pace over the course of the last 6 months. And if we look at Autodesk, then they have also adopted a subscription business model. In the UK, Sage has pulled back over the course of the last few months because it's had teething problems with employing that subscription business model. But there is an important point, and that is that generally speaking, when you have a technology sector which has been characterized by cyclicality over its entire history, because you get a big bump in sales when you bring out your new product, and then you have to spend the next few years developing the next product and maintaining the last one, and then when the next product comes up, you get another big bump in sales. So you get very lumpy series of cash flows. When you adopt a subscription business model, well, then you get to smooth out those cash flows, and you have a much more modelable way of reporting earnings, and then that tends to command a higher multiple. Well, some of the companies that are leading the momentum are Amazon, which is still really quite overextended relative to the trend mean, but so far this has been I think it unwound some of the overbought condition, and it's now back at the previous peak. The question I think people will be asking is whether, if markets are being led higher by these high momentum large cap technology shares, then, and they accelerate away from their peaks, well, is that going to represent an acceleration of this trend? And is this going to be what I think BCA research has been talking about, is the last big hurrah in what has been an already very impressive bull market? One of the questions that people have been asking has been about the fact that PE ratios are on the high side, that on a cyclically adjusted basis, that particularly on the Shiller CAPE, then we are at levels that haven't been seen only once previously. So what that suggests is that it is difficult to make the argument that some of these shares are cheap. And when we look at, for example, Amazon, it still has a PE on an estimated basis of 133. Netflix is trading on an estimated PE of 112, and Tesla doesn't have a PE because they've got negative earnings. So the share, for example, Tesla is now trading below $300. The very first example from the trend, from the chart seminar, is that past support can become future resistance, and we're starting to see some evidence of that in Tesla. The big question many people will continue to ask is whether it can push back above the $300 area. And these are, I think, all of these are the small questions. The really big question is, when are we going to have the next recession? We've had periods of volatility before, and the big question is, when does a period of volatility represent a medium-term pause, and when does a period of volatility represent a top? Well, then the arbiter there will be, where are we in terms of the cycle? And we know that valuations are a bit on the pricey side, so we're not early in the cycle. And then the big question is, well, how late are we in the cycle? Well, we can look at the yield curve spread, and we know that the yield curve spread is contracting, but it is not negative. And as long as it is not negative, then we don't have the same degree of, as long as it's not negative, we do not have a red light in terms of a lead indicator for a future recession. Then that's an important point. It means that some people have been worried that that earnings are about as good as they can get. And part of the reason for that is because Caterpillar, in their conference call after their earnings were announced, said exactly that. They basically said things are not going to get any better. And I think that contributed to a loss of faith in the ability of this bull market to persist. The only way that you can justify high PE ratios is if you also have high earnings. And if the earnings start to deteriorate, well, that is going to represent a headwind. But one of the things that animated the market in here today was that unemployment fell to a new low. It hasn't been this low since 2000. And that wage inflation has not taken off. Now, I think that it's important to look at a number of different indicators. So we can see that that the yield curve spread is not saying there's going to be a recession in the next 6 months. It doesn't mean that it's not going to become inverted in future and that we're never going to have a recession again. Of course we're going to have recessions in future. But when we look at just about everything that we have at our disposal, there's no indication yet that we're going to have a recession. High yield spreads have been contained within this range for the last almost 18 months. And we know that that's not going to persist indefinitely. Eventually, high yield spreads are going to break out, and they'll have to be trending for a while before they represent a significant headwind. But they have not broken out yet, and therefore there is not a great deal of evidence of stress in the high yield market. Now, obviously, we've seen that yields have risen, so the fact that the spread is going sideways tells us that the yield on both investment grade and junk bonds is simply rising at the same pace. That doesn't necessarily mean that junk bonds are necessarily an attractive asset. When we look at, for example, the performance of some of the high yield bond ETFs, they have first step below the top characteristics. There's a very clear rolling over characteristic to the trading over the course of the last 2 years. So what that tells me is that we may not have evidence of acute stress in the market yet that can have a knock-on effect for the equity markets, but neither does it look particularly bullish. And again, what that suggests is that we are probably late in the cycle, but perhaps not that the cycle is over. And that is, I think, one of the perhaps the more important points. If unemployment is still making new lows, if the yield curve spread might be contracting but is not negative, and if junk bond spreads are contained, then the only other thing that we tend to look at is the oil price. And the oil price is rallying, but it's not surging higher. And that, again, is another important point, that if we were to see oil prices rally in a similar manner to how they rallied in 2008, where we saw the price go from about $60, oh, excuse me, about $80 in late 2007, very quickly to a peak over 140, within the course of less than a year, then that's the kind of surge in oil prices that can act as a significant headwind to global growth. We can think about it this way, that every $10 move in oil prices either contributes or detracts something like 0.2 of 1% to GDP. If oil prices were within the next 6 months to go from $75 to $120, well, then we'd be talking about shaving a percent off of global GDP. And for economies that are already not growing particularly quickly, then that would be a significant headwind. For the kinds of economies that depend on imports, it would be an even stronger headwind. So I think these are important points, that we don't really have any evidence that we're about to have a recession. And what that suggests is that this is a medium-term correction, and probably that's all it is. As long as these indices continue to bounce from the region of their respective trend means, then that represents, I think, evidence that demand is still returning to dominance, and that if we're getting higher reaction lows, it tells us only one thing. It's that people are willing to pay more to own something whenever it pulls back, and that they're not willing to wait for it to get all the way down to the last low, that they're anticipating that there will be a bounce, and by anticipating the bounce, they are contributing to the bounce occurring earlier. Oil prices are firm, and they were up another dollar in here today, and pushing back up towards this psychological 75 area. And this has been a comparatively shallow reaction, particularly considering that all the way up from the lows last year, that reactions were in the order of about $3.50 to $4 and sometimes $5. This one was only $2.50. So a shallow reaction so far, and upside follow through next week would reassert the medium-term demand-dominated environment. And this, when we look at the commodity curve, we can see that there is a a rather wide backwardation, particularly between the first and the second month, but that the curve is in backwardation all the way out to at least 2023. So the fact that you have supply being constrained in Venezuela and the potential for sanctions on Iran, and on top of the fact that Russia and OPEC continue to reduce their supply, that's all contributing to additional interest in the energy sector. And that is acting as a tailwind for a lot of other points within the energy sector. So we're starting to see some evidence of a return of interest in uranium. And the fact that NASA announced this week that they were able to build a brand new kind of reactor, the first new design to be of a reactor to be built in the USA in the last 40 years, and to do it for less than $20 million, is a very interesting prospect. And the fact that it is that they say at least that it is almost immune to risk of meltdown, and that it can simply be buried in the ground and run for over 10 years. That's something that the way they overcame the not in my backyard argument was to say that they're going to deploy it in space. I don't think you can get a starker example of not in my backyard or NIMBY policies anywhere. But the fact that they were able to do this suggests that there is a market for Generation 4 and even potentially Generation 5 reactors if they can overcome the incredibly negative sentiment towards the sector. Cameco has now rallied to post a new recovery high. It's bounced from the 10 Canadian dollar level on multiple occasions, and if it can follow through on the upside, and most particularly if it can hold the move above the trend mean, well, then we might be able to start talking about base formation completion and a return to medium-term demand dominance. Coal is about the most unloved of all the energy commodities, but it's also essential to the global economy. And Glencore produces a lot of different commodities, but it produces a lot of coal. And it continues to hold this move above the 350p level. That had been an area of resistance all the way between 2012 and 2015, and now it is potentially an area where people will start to think about it as support. So, as long as it's holding the low that we saw in probably put in March or early April, then we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. What I find particularly interesting is that the continuous commodity index has been going sideways for the last almost 2 years. But we have a clear progression of higher reaction lows since the middle of last year, and it is looking increasingly likely that it is going to be able to break on the upside. The LME Metals Index has got a pretty similar pattern to the industrial resources. It has been ranging for most of this year so far, but as long as it's holding the region of the trend mean, we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But it's in the grains and beans that we are, I think, really starting to see a return to investor interest. So when we look at the likes of corn and soybeans, then they're coming back up towards the upper side of their base formation. And this is a spot index for grains. But when we look at the individual commodities, this is almost exactly what they look like. And they're depressed. It's been years since we've seen a meaningful move in the grains and beans. Cocoa has already broken upwards, and it continues to advance in an aggressive manner. Then, although I did not look at it before I recorded the audio, and perhaps we are now seeing some pause and consolidation for cocoa. But sugar has been very close to its lows, and it has so far not received any real tailwind from the conversion of the increasing demand for ethanol in Brazil rather than gasoline, which should help to soak up some of the additional supply in the sugar market. But it is now back in the region of the 2015 lows, so this is a rather depressed level. And Arabica coffee has also been going down for more than a year already, but we're starting to see some just tas I think the beginning of evidence that demand is returning to dominance. It has not quite been able to hold its rally in here this week, but if it can continue to sustain the move above 125, well, then we can say that the downtrend has been broken. And so far, well, we're only a couple of points away from it being able to do that, provided, of course, that it can rally next week. And when we think about the potential for inflationary pressures to rise, well, we know that we have almost full employment in the USA, that unemployment levels in Europe are contracting, and that there are labor shortages in Japan. So that alone has the potential for wages to increase. Then when we look at the grains and beans and the agricultural commodities, these represent food items, and it is food price inflation that tends to really kick off geopolitical tensions. Certainly, if we think about how the Arab Spring got started, it was because of food riots in Tunisia, because the price of wheat had been surging so much. And now we are at reasonably depressed levels, but there is increasing evidence of base formation completion in the grains and beans. Now, generally speaking, when we look at the performance of cyclical sectors, I think that it's a bit of a stretch now to regard the technology sector as cyclical because there has been such a widespread adoption of the subscription model. But commodities are definitely cyclical, and they do tend to outperform in the latter stages of a bull market, and that does look to be increasingly likely that when we look at some of the most depressed sectors within the commodities, then they are starting to show signs of life. I think what we can definitely start to think about is that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And it was iron ore was the clear leader in the big commodity bull market that peaked in 2011. It's been lithium and cobalt have been among the better performers on this occasion. But uranium, coal, and the grains and beans are still really quite depressed, and they do have the potential to play catch up in this kind of environment where people will look at the high momentum shares represented by the big technology companies, and they'll start to think about looking for bargains. And the commodity sector continues to represent a bargain basement prices. But then if you have inflation with record low unemployment, it is only a matter of time before you start to get wage demand growth. I think there is a reasonable argument for saying that wage demand growth has probably been contained in the USA because of the tax cuts, that when you get more money in your paycheck simply because the tax code has been changed, well, then that is going to take some of the impetus out of wage demands when you negotiate with your boss. But the wage hike that people will have got because of the fiscal stimulus will wash out over the course of the next year, at which point people will again start asking for additional wages. And the price of subscription-oriented businesses are rising. Amazon has raised its subscription cost by $20. Netflix tends to raise its price every couple of years. Microsoft has also been raising the price of of its subscription. So these are, I think, important points, that it's a lot easier to raise your prices when you have a subscription model. And that's important when we think about the outlook for bonds. Because if commodity prices are rallying, not only because of a supply and elasticity meets rising demand environment, but because of inflationary pressures, and bond yields are currently in the region of 3%. And we can see that there is approximately 35 basis points of an overextension relative to the trend mean. It's not at all beyond the bounds of possibility that we get that overextension being closed before we see a move back above 3%. So bonds are a little bit oversold in the very short term, and we don't have urgent evidence of inflationary pressures rising, but we can certainly see that there are signals that we can anticipate that inflation will rise over the course of the next year or two. One of the other sectors that seems to be doing very well at the moment is luxury goods. And there are perhaps two reasons for that. Well, one would perhaps be that the Chinese are buying once more, and that the Chinese Communist Party has taken less of a, I think, it became very unfashionable among the party cadres to be seen wearing or carrying luxury goods in the period shortly after Xi Jinping took power. Some of the impetus is coming off of that, and shares like Louis Vuitton and Kering and indeed Ferrari are all doing well. But there is an additional way of thinking about that, and it is that these kinds of companies produce desirable objects that do tend to rise in value over time, and that by front-loading purchases now, then you can take advantage of inflation. That the art market and the luxury goods markets are rather closely intertwined. I also know that my phone has been ringing almost every day this week from real estate brokers trying to sell me a house, or try to encourage me to buy a house. And I find that interesting. They certainly weren't calling 3 months ago, and they weren't calling 6 months ago. Now, either I also know that houses have been selling very quickly around where I live. Well, that also is, I think, people front-loading purchases because they're wary of inflation and the outlook that that's likely to have on interest rates. When we look at the total return on bonds, then that is another important chart, because this was one of the most consistent trends in the world from the beginning of this index in 1982 until approximately 2014. And then we saw a loss of momentum. And this is the first time that the index has been going sideways like this, and that it has been prone to these larger pullbacks. And now it is testing the lower side of what has been already a 3.5-year range. Well, this looks like an evolving Type 3 top formation. And that's not good news. I'll never forget that I was at a meeting, I was at a double line meeting, and one of the salespeople was chatting with me afterwards, and I mentioned this index, and he said, oh, well, maybe it could never go down. I thought that was a very interesting telltale sign that people tend to be conditioned by the bull market, that when you have lived through a bull market and never seen a bear market, then it's very difficult to anticipate what's going to happen next. But if yields have bottomed, and if the total return on yield on bonds is reversing, that if the total return starts going negative year on year, that is going to have a profound effect on the composition of portfolios. The vast majority of investors tend to have what they consider to be balanced portfolios, where they have 60-40 bonds to equities. And if they're really ambitious, they tend to have 50-50, or they tend to have 40-60 in terms of bonds to equities. But they always have bonds. And they have bonds because of the perception of security. And of course, they have a perception of security because they only ever went up between 1980 and approximately 2016. Well, that is going to represent a considerable challenge for the financial industry if bonds are underperforming. But what are the kinds of shares that do best in that kind of environment, where you have rising yields and bonds underperforming? Well, there are the bond proxies, which have been bid up in much the same manner as bonds. So they're going to get a re-rating. And we have seen some of that already. The consumer staples sector has pulled back really quite aggressively over the course of this corrective phase. And it has broken its progression of higher reaction lows. And then the question is it due some pause and consolidation? Well, it is. It is due a pause. Kraft Heinz today had, I think, well, let me just see where it closed out the day, but it looked like an upside Q reversal. Not quite. It wasn't quite able to hold the move to a new high. But if we get upside follow-through next week, well, that will raise the prospect of at least a reversion back up towards the mean. When we think about the outlook for these kinds of bond proxies, then that is part of the reason that people were buying them, because they had such reliable cash flows and such long histories of paying out attractive dividends. But in a rising yield environment, then they need to be raising their dividends in an aggressive manner. If they don't raise their dividends in an aggressive manner, then their prices will come down so that the yields become more attractive. And the only way that they're going to be able to raise their dividends is if their margins either remain the same or increase. And the only way they can do that is to either raise prices or cut their expenditures even more aggressively. Well, companies have already cut a lot, and the way that they've been of getting growth has been by buying it. And we're certainly, the reason that Kraft Heinz was rallying in here today was because there is speculation that they are going to revitalize coffee. There was also news that Nestle is talking about buying the what is effectively the wholesale arm of Starbucks. So that has contributed to some additional interest in these kinds of shares. But they represent a risk when you have all those people that bought them for their yields. However, they do have the potential to do well in an environment where you have a rising global population with an improving standard of living, because these types of companies are experts at building a brand internationally. And if you have an additional 2 billion consumers, and we are going to have an additional 2 billion consumers in the next 20 to 30 years, then these types of companies have the potential to grow internationally. And that will continue to contribute to the sustainability of their cash flows. And we've seen plenty of evidence that even companies like Coca-Cola can embrace the health food market. And part of the reason I think that a lot of people have been rather leery of the processed food market is because of declining demand as a result of health fads. Well, Coca-Cola is now coming back down towards the progression of higher reaction lows, and there has very clearly been a loss of momentum over the last few years. It is, I think, probably taking more of a hit because of it being a bond proxy rather than the sustainability of its business model. What that suggests to me is that these types of companies are going to be teed up for very attractive buying opportunities, but perhaps not yet, or at least not until their yields become truly attractive. 3.5% has represented an area of support for these kinds of dividend aristocrat companies on successive occasions over the course of the last decade, and in some cases more than that. But the question today is that enough if 10-year Treasury yields are at 3%? It was enough back in 2010, but yields, the relative spread was lower. So that might suggest that instead of 3.5% being a floor, then it may in fact represent an area of resistance in future. That's a big question. That's something that has not yet been answered, but it does represent a challenge for these consumer staple type companies because they have been considered to be bond proxies. So if those are the companies that are at risk, what are the kinds of companies that are going to do well? Well, it's going to be the high growth companies, and it's going to be the companies that can really boost their dividends in an aggressive manner. So that means that they're going to have growing businesses. And we're already seeing that the technology sector is a sector that can both grow quickly and increase its dividends in a rapid manner. And if we look at the kinds of technology companies that are paying out dividends, like Apple or Microsoft or Cisco Systems, well, then that is the kind of situation that we have by and large for the global sector. So I think these are important points to bear in mind. What we also see is that we are in a medium-term correction for stocks, and that there's increasing evidence of sectors that are breaking on the upside. And it's in the technology sector that we're seeing the growth. What this, I think, suggests to me is that when we think about the very long term, then we have to think about it in terms of where are we in terms of these long-term cycles. The Dow Gold Ratio tends to have higher highs over the course of major equity bull markets. The last peak was in 2000. There's approximately 35 years between the peaks, so the next peak is likely to be sometime in the early 2030s, and probably at a level above 40. Well, all of that period between 1980 and 2000 was punctuated by recessions. We had a couple of crashes along the way as well, and the ratio continued to advance, and the index continued to push up in a very aggressive manner. And I think that the balance of probabilities is that we are in a similar secular bull market right now. And there are arguments by people in the bond markets that bond yields will not be able to rise, or that interest rates will not be able to rise very much beyond 3 or 4%, for the simple reason that there is such an incredible amount of debt. The USA has embarked upon a massive fiscal stimulus, and sooner or later the bond vigilantes and debt hawks are going to start coming back into force, and that is going to represent a challenge. It may also coincide with the next recession, and at that point yields may start to come back down. But the next big recession, just like any recession within the period between 1980 and 2000, is going to be a wonderful buying opportunity from the perspective of a long-term bull, I think, or a long-term investor. There are I think, three very important themes in terms of the secular bull market, and technological innovation is certainly one of them. And most particularly, technological innovation in the energy and healthcare sectors can have profound effects on global productivity and economic growth. That the US, excuse me, the global economy spends approximately $6 trillion a year on oil, or on energy, more particularly. And the global economy spends approximately $1 trillion a year on cancer. So when we think about it in those terms, these are, I think, very important points, because what it means is that we have an environment which is primed for change. There is the incredible innovation that we're getting in the biotechnology sector. And I think it's just been in the last couple of months that we've seen two very important pieces of accelerating technological advance. With the immuno-oncology and the creation of, or the, I think, the invention or discovery of CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing, it's massively accelerated the pace of innovation in biotechnology. When that has been twinned with immuno-oncology, they've had success since the middle of last year with treating leukemia, and the success rates have been quite significant relative to what had previously been a killer disease. Then there was people were anticipating that it would take anything from 5 or 6 years to have similar success results with solid tumors. But in fact, it has occurred in less than 6 months. So that is an example of exponential growth in the technology sector. Then it's the same thing with battery chemistry, that I've seen reports in the last year predicting that we could be 2030 before we get to a commercialization of battery chemistries that would be 8-to-1-to-1 nickel to manganese to cobalt in lithium batteries, whereas Tesla announced this week that they already have those batteries in their Model 3 sedans. So again, that's an additional example of exponential growth in the technology sector. The fact that NASA can come through and produce a nuclear reactor for less than $20 million is quite incredible. It's, you can't even get a roundabout on a busy road put in for less than $20 million. So that's an incredible innovation. And these are the kinds of innovations that can have profound effects on productivity. What I find very interesting, and someone kindly sent through an article from the Washington Post, I posted it yesterday, where they were arguing that social media has not contributed to productivity growth. And I think anybody would be inclined to agree with that. Looking at endless videos of people, of cats and people falling over on YouTube, is not conducive to productivity growth, probably the opposite. Spending half your day posting photos on social media is also not particularly effective. But then we also have to at least acknowledge that Facebook has got a business model that works, that by accumulating all of this data, that they can then parse it and sell it on. And that has been one of the factors that has contributed to what has so far been a reasonably consistent advance. It certainly pulled back, and now it is trading back above the trend mean. And I think as long as it's holding that $150 area, I think we can give it the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Well, that also helps to, I think, to point towards the fact that just because a company is making a lot of money, that it may not be producing the kind of productivity gains the economy needs for sustainable growth. But there are other areas of technological innovation that are doing that. And it is most particularly in those areas where we're seeing exponential growth coming through that there is the greatest possibility for productivity growth. Then you have automation. And the simple fact is that if you can control for energy costs, and I think that that is a reasonable prospect over the course of the next 20 years, that energy prices will likely range rather than trend. If that's indeed the case, then part of the reason that you have a lot of offshoring and you had the introduction of a global supply chain or logistics network over the course of the last 40 years was because of cheap labor, cheap energy, and low regulation. Well, if you can control for energy because of technological innovation and the fact that we've had a bull market and now we are likely to have another lengthy ranging phase, and if you can then control for labor costs through automation, then the strict need for a global logistics level is global logistics infrastructure is contained. And there's an awful lot of money that gets spent on defense and maintaining that global infrastructure network. If you no longer require it to sustain low-cost environments, and that is, I think, an awfully big question for the medium term. When we think about the fact that you have rising inequality and you have a pockmarked economy in North America and Europe, where whole industries have been lifted out of once dynamic areas and left them barren in terms of their economic potential. Well, that's been going on for an awfully long time. And now you have a critical mass of people who are hopping mad and not willing to accept it any longer. We have seen the rise of populism, which has been largely, I think, considered to be either populist, racist, xenophobic, but most particularly, it has been considered to be an insurgent movement. But I think that that is underestimating the potential. I think that it is a popular movement. Insurgents generally don't last very long, whereas a popular movement tends to stick around and grasp power. And we've seen increasing evidence of that. And it's likely to persist because we are seeing, I think, a significant change. Most particularly because the one country that has benefited most from offshoring is China. And China is becoming progressively more despotic, rather than the hoped-for flowering of democracy and liberalism. Rather, the opposite has occurred. And if they have benefited most from from globalization, then if we are moving towards a more competitive environment where many economies will be relying more on automation and lower energy prices, well, with automation and with technological innovation, some of those regulatory issues can also be addressed. Regulatory issues are a decision rather than an imposition. So that is something that has the potential to change. What it suggests is that we are now in a multipolar world, and that is setting up additional questions about the sustainability of global business models. The business models that are most likely to persist are those that are consumer-oriented, that are looking at the major global population centers. China is certainly one of them, but all of the population growth that is going to happen in the next 20 years is likely going to be, or at least Africa is going to represent a significant proportion of that. And it is in Africa that the big race is going to be on to gain market share. It isn't for no reason that Google and Facebook are investing in satellites to deliver free internet to the entire African continent. It's because that's their last hope for additional consumer growth. I think these are the this is the outlook that we can anticipate, that we're going to get productivity growth. It's going to start coming through in the latter half of this bull market. We are going to get some inflation because we haven't had any at all, and inflationary pressures are rising. If we're getting productivity growth, well, then people can afford to ask for more wages. And then you do get more spending and you get a more dynamic environment. I think that is the recipe for the latter half of this bull market. The fact that bonds have been so very high for so very long suggests that they are not going to perform in nearly the same manner over the course of the next 30 years. They're probably going to be a bad investment. So, what does that then tell us about what's going to happen with gold? Well, gold is a hard asset. Gold is something that people can own that does not, or it's not something that can be simply printed into existence. And it is now right in the region of the trend mean. With yields starting to rise, and with the luxury goods doing better, and I think with the signs that inflationary pressures are starting to appear, then there is the realistic possibility that gold will start to reflect that. And it is now in the region of the trend mean and just beginning to show signs of firming. And it certainly hasn't convinced anybody just yet. It needs to have very clear upward dynamics. But I'm reasonably bullish about the gold price, because the last time we saw something that was akin to this kind of environment was back in the early 2000s, where we had a very big move to break the downtrend in 1999, and then this saucering pattern for the next few years that gave way to an incredibly impressive bull market. And we had a similar big move in 2016, and we've had this ranging consolidation since. And as long as we hold the progression of higher reaction lows, then I think it is inevitable that we're going to see gold breaking on the upside. And ranges are explosions waiting to happen, so when it breaks upwards, it is going to do so in an emphatic manner. The other asset class that I think a lot of people are becoming more interested in is Bitcoin. It had a phenomenal bull market last year, and it is now pausing around the 10,000 level. It has rallied reasonably impressively over the course of the last month, and 10,000 is a big psychological level. I think in order to really demonstrate that it's back in a demand-dominated environment, it really does have to sustain a move back above the 10,000 level. But the bigger picture is that Bitcoin was the first, it's still the largest, but it has some of the oldest infrastructure as well. When we look at Ethereum, then that might be considered the better bet. And it has rallied almost 100% since the beginning of March. And that is, I think, now demonstrating clear relative strength. And when you get a big collapse, then the thing that one has to look for after a cataclysmic decline or a burst bubble is early relative strength. The epicenter of risk is generally the asset that is most likely to form a Type 3 sleeper base formation, which is going to be characterized by a great deal of ranging. What we then look for is relative strength, something that pulled back in a similar manner, and certainly Ethereum pulled back in a similar manner, but that initially starts to show clear relative strength and leadership. And Ethereum is doing that. It has now got a progression of higher reaction lows, and it is trending reasonably consistently. And what that suggests to me is that this is one of the better candidates to represent the leadership within a recovery situation for cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology generally. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.